Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a good one, Stone.
Hey, I've been looking forward to this for several days now. You know, you missed my birthday. You were down in South Florida.
I sent you a note.
Well, I appreciate it. But on my birthday, I was all by myself because my wife was traveling as well. And I started doing the rare bit of pre-show research and got kind of jazzed up about this episode. So you're right. It's going to be a fantastic segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Chief Technology Officer with Park Mobile, Mr. Andrew Hamilton. But first up on the Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the director for the Entrepreneurship and Innovation Institute of the J.Mack Robinson College of Business at Georgia State University. Please join me in welcoming to the program Dr. Richard Welke. How are you, sir?
I am fine. Thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Welke, can you share a little bit about the center? What is the vision and mission?
Right. The Institute.
Or the Institute. That's even better than the center.
Yeah. Universities have this strange hierarchy of things. So centers are fundamentally for research, and they cannot offer courses directly. Institutes are like departments or schools in the sense that they can run their own programs and create their own courses. So we used to have Herman J. Russell Center for Entrepreneurship, still do. But that wasn't a course-creating entity. So we needed something to accelerate the development of entrepreneurial courses on campus. And so that was the rationale for creating an institute. The idea was, and still is, that we create a set of course building blocks that can be used not just within the Robinson College of Business, but across the entire campus. And so that is a bit unique in the sense that many of these programs are based within a business school and are available only to business students.
So it would be a track within business in most cases, and you're kind of broadening it outside of the business school.
That is correct. And so the first one we have is media entrepreneurship. And so that is a combination of courses out of the Creative Media Industries Institute that was just created about a year and a half ago. And now we're developing and now have on the books a second one, which is in social entrepreneurship. And that's in combination with the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies. And we have a few more queued up at the undergraduate level. Then at the graduate level, we've taken a similar approach, except our orientation there is away from startups and more towards entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm. And because that's within a larger enterprise.
Yeah. In other words, so a company wishes to sort of head off, shall we say, being innovated from the outside or what's sometimes called disruptive innovation by essentially creating their own greenhouses in which they develop their own competing products. And so that is given the name intrapreneurship. And so we have a similar set of building blocks that are currently being used by Biomed. And so we have a Biomed Enterprise program, which takes our set of building blocks and adds to it the Biomed courses.
So entrepreneurship, now, is this really just born in you or can it be taught?
Yes. Okay, so this is there's two views.
The answer is yes, right? Yes. That's what I'm sensing.
Okay. Well, there's certain characteristics of successful entrepreneurs that we cannot teach. Some have to do with a propensity for risk. Others have to do with stick-with-itness. And probably the latter is the more important. So, fighting your way through the tough times and coming out at the other end and knowing that there is another end to come out on is a kind of key characteristic. We can't teach that. We can simulate it. But what we have discovered is we have a lot of students with what they believe to be really good ideas to start companies. And what we find in talking to them is they lack a sense of, is there any demand for that? I mean, legitimate demand? Could they get demand traction? do they have a functioning business model? In other words, how are they going to make money? And even if you're in social entrepreneurship, you still have to make money. I mean, you have to keep the lights on, even if you're a 401 or a 403C. So these are some of the basic things, how to quickly get to some kind of a market with a minimally viable product. These are all things that we know how to teach and can convey to students. And so that's the instructional piece of this. We do it experientially so that students actually have to go out into the real world and prove that they've talked to people on the street, so to speak.
Oh, that is great. I am delighted to hear that part. So a great deal of this is experiential.
Yes. And, you know, of course, that is time consuming. So it sort of competes against, well, why aren't you running course size sections of 50 or 60? And the answer is, well, you just can't run experiential courses of size 50 and 60, not in any useful fashion. So we have little battles about that. But we're sticking very, very heavily to the notion that all of our courses have to be experiential.
Now, did you come up with your own kind of GSU methodology of how to teach entrepreneurship? Or is this something like, are you leaning on like Lean Startup or some of the existing ways to go to market right now?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the best practice is codified in various things like Osterwalder and Pinuer's business model generation book and their value proposition book. And of course, Blank's work on, you know, Four Steps to the Epiphany. And Lean Startup is another resource. But then we find that we need other things to fill in the cracks because each of these things takes a different perspective, and it's not clear where the handoff is between A and B or in what sequences students should sort of follow some kind of a script. So we've developed something called the AVID methodology that tries to tie all this together and also puts a heavier emphasis on demand creation.
Now, isn't entrepreneurship have to balance kind of an art and science?
You bet.
So, but how is that codified?
Oh yes. Well, okay.
That's a new word for Lee, by the way. Codified. First time you've heard it was this morning.
Well, it's. I mean, there's books that basically say, here's what you do first. Here's how you lay it out. Here's some tools that you can use to support that. So I consider that to be codification. But then, as you say, there's the art of that, which is, yeah, you can scribble out a business plan, but, you know, there may be nothing behind it. And so what is it that you do as an individual to, in effect, make it real? Because at some point, you're going to get involved in a pitch competition or you're going to get involved in a business model competition. And so the Shark Tank-like folks come after you, and you have to have both empathy and sort of passion, okay? And that doesn't come from just following a methodology.
And it's also vision. I mean, like if you look at, like take Netflix, where they came in and they were going to, you know, they at first went after Blockbuster because they yes. were doing DVDs. And then they said, hey, let's blow up this whole model and do yes. streaming. And everybody thought that that was insanity. They had, you know, a golden goose there.
Sure. Well, okay, so just to give you an example of one little trick we do, we give students a scenario. And so in that scenario, they have to create a business model. So they spend 45 minutes or a half or an hour doing that. Okay, and then when they're about to prepare it or present it, we say, okay, tear that one up.
The one that they just spent all this mental
exactly.
energy on.
This is not a happy moment in the classroom. And so come up with another one. And sometimes we'll even do it a third time. And so they have to get used to the idea of not being comfortable with the obvious, but essentially starting to explore the edge. And often they'll tell you at the end of that exercise that the second or third one they came up with, in fact, was better than the first mm-hmm. one.
I'm thrilled about it. I'm absolutely thrilled about it. But I got to tell you, I'm a little bit surprised that this topic of entrepreneurship is getting university level attention. What's why?
yes. Well, the politics of life.
Because okay. before, where were entrepreneurs learning about all this?
Well, they were learning it mostly. Well, We've been teaching entrepreneurship on our campus, I believe, now for 15 years.
All right. So you've been at it longer than I thought, but it just seems like there's a new energy behind this. Yeah?
Okay. So the answer to that question is the following. There is a group of individuals that are presidents of universities, and it's called something to the effect of the Land-Grant University Consortium. And so they decided that the way that the economy of the United States is going to move forward is not by the N plus first large company, but rather by a much greater emphasis on creating entrepreneurs and more innovation. So they essentially put down a white paper on what they meant by that and why that was important. And then they got 140 major university presidents to sign off on the fact that they would do everything they could to increase the amount of entrepreneurship and innovation at their universities. And so one of the signatories to that was Dr. Mark Becker, our president, but also from UGA, also from Georgia Tech, and from countries all around the universities all around the United States. And so then the race was on, so to speak. And that was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago that happened.
Now, I went to a graduation of a college. My nephew, I think it was maybe 5 years ago, 7 years ago. And at the dean or whatever is speaking at the end. And they were always talking about how now that your children are equipped to get a job in this marketplace. That was a get a job. It was always job oriented. And now you're prepared to get a job. And this seems like a kind of a paradigm shift, because this is saying you're going to create your own job. And your job, you know, it'd be great if some of the people that go through this are, you know, creating these unicorns, these billion-dollar companies. But the reality of it is the vast majority are going to fail multiple times to even hit a single, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
That's built into this process. It's at the level of expectations totally different. You have to build a level of resilience for these people to be able to fail fast, and then get back up and do it again. That's a different skill set than get a job.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, yeah, failure, well, yeah, they say failure is about 50% in the first year, according to some of the recent data. But then on the other hand, 60% of people that are surveyed are in small businesses. So take a look. number two, failure is partly a matter of expectation. So if your expectation is that you're going to scale up and become a unicorn or even just a very successful local operation, that's different from people who are creating businesses for what we call lifestyle businesses. So they're a musician, they're a copywriter, they're someone who does branding or design. All right, the days of where these people are being hired by corporations is pretty much gone.
Right, but aren't those entrepreneurs? Isn't the musician
an
entrepreneur? Isn't the copywriter an entrepreneur?
Yes, they are.
Because their business is them.
That is correct.
That brings up a good point. Your kid, Lee, is going to GSU.
Right.
Probably not on the business school track, right? He's more in that arts entertainment kind of, that's. But he will have access to some of this content, won't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's intentional.
Yeah, speak to that a little bit, if you will.
Yeah, that's the intention of the design, is that we believe entrepreneurship isn't something that's a business thing per se. What it is a set of activities that you have to go through in order to take your passion, whatever that passion may be. And, playing an instrument is a passion. Designing or copywriting material is a passion. Helping develop branding or packaging is a passion. And so these individuals increasingly are not being hired by large corporations. They're being outsourced. They're having to essentially compete in a gig economy marketplace, and they have to know how to do that. And they can have just as clever business models as, well, I charge so much per hour. Well, okay, maybe I give it away and ask for something in a different fashion,
right,
on a quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. And so we can create business models for any of these entities. So we would like to see every one of the university departments, okay,
start thinking entrepreneurially. And once they do, then the students need some way to package that up because ultimately they want to get a degree. And so we offer that. Now, I'll add that a number of students are not course-oriented. In other words, sort of information on demand. So we run something called the Startup Semester. It's a non-credit course. It takes them through 10 weeks. Again, somewhat like our first introductory course, but without the requirement that they register, pay for tuition, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's popular. We also run little workshop for students. And then we run a number of challenges that get students engaged in this. So we don't require them to have an idea. We provide what you might call failed IP. And then their job is to figure out a business model that would work for that failed IP and a brand and marketing and everything else that would work for that failed IP. And then they each individually or group-wise present that to the company that had the failed IP. So we're doing one just coming up on social entrepreneurship for low-income housing.
All right. You don't sound like any professor I ever had. You seem like you're very different. What is your backstory? You haven't always been in the academe, have you?
No, they call me a pracademic.
Yeah, I think that's a good moniker for you.
So I started two companies just after I graduated from Buffalo as a PhD. I went to McMaster in Hamilton, Ontario, because as I said, it was midway between where my mom washed my clothes and where my school was. it was a nice place, but a little boring. So I started one company importing Dynabyte microcomputers and developing software for it. And then I started another company called MethodsWorks. And then I used that company as leverage to buy the software company in Ann Arbor called Istos that I was using, or essentially licensing for use. And then I sold all of that along with some other stuff to Learmonth Burchett in the UK, went off to the Netherlands, and then I came back. Then I was the CIO interim for Law Group, as it was called then. And then I became, through a connection, with Herman J. Russell, they needed a CIO for their company. So I...
You can't hold a job, can you?
I've held my job at Georgia State for 25 years. So, but I like to do things on the side that are, how should we say, practically stimulating. Mm-hmm. I was a co-op student from almost the get-go in my undergraduate years. And I just consider myself a perpetual co-op student. So I need the stimulus and an intellectual company of a university, but I need the reality and practicality of the real world. And so then my most recent stint was as interim CIO for Park Mobile. And that was because I was a good friend of Albert Bogard from the Netherlands days.
Now, today's student is entering an economy in a world that's a lot different than when you graduated. If you were starting again, how would you attack this kind of, you're going to college. College is important, right? We agree on that. Some people don't agree on that, right?
Yep.
But we agree college is important to go through that process. How would you attack it as an undergraduate nowadays?
Well, I didn't know that I was an entrepreneur or had entrepreneurial inklings when I was going through. And there was a lot of peer pressure to, sort of get a job, as there still is. I mean, we have roughly 50 or 60% of our GSU students are on Pell scholarships and grants, which means, they don't have a lot of free change rattling around in their pockets, and they typically don't have parents that can support angel investing. So, and they need to pay off student loans. So in entrepreneurship, at best, says you're not going to get your own income for some time,
right?
And you may have to get other people's money as well to make it get a get go. So that's a complexity, and I think if you're driven by this passion, though, you need to sort of vet, the least risky time that you can do this is when you graduate. You know, when you're 40 or 50, that's actually more risky.
Right, when you got nothing, you have nothing
to
lose.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Before that mortgage, before those kids.
You got
it. I hear you.
And that's,
I wish somebody had told me that, Richard.
I mean, that's why I did the first one when I initially, after I graduated from the university, was I figured if I couldn't do it now, in 10 years, I would be so wrapped up in something else that I wouldn't ever get back, and that would be a major regret for me. So I said, okay, I'll invest in myself, and I did.
Mm-hmm. So then you'd follow that through. So if you're going to be, it would be wise to explore something entrepreneurial.
Yes, because
as soon as you can, even freshmen going in, sophomore, you know, get the lay of the land and then just find something you're passionate about and just try to figure out a business model around it.
Well, the that's part A. I think part B is that a lot of companies are looking for individuals who have entrepreneurial skills. Mm. I mean, they don't they want a multi-purpose tool, so to speak. Somebody who's willing to take a bit of risk, someone who sees the consequences, someone who can present a new idea in an effective fashion to that company, and sort of stir things up a little bit. And so those are skills that you develop as an entrepreneur, but you may not develop those skills if you study for a CPA or if you follow a traditional path in marketing or ops management.
And then the final question on this topic is, why GSU?
Why not? You mean, why is it happening?
Why should you choose GSU if you were...
Because number one, okay... We're not a major technology university, although we're rapidly becoming one. So, you know, our STEM is more on the science side than on the technology, or and certainly not the engineering, because we don't have an engineering school. So if you're interested in the peripheral areas to STEM, which are math or science or any of the soft sciences, such as in arts and arts and sciences. I mean, languages, okay? There's all kinds of business models for languages. So if you're interested in something that isn't computer science or engineering, then GSU is really your only choice.
Now, you mentioned that media entrepreneurship is the first foray in this.
It was the first, yes.
Right, so now what is that? Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what did that mean? What is it?
Sure. Well, I could talk about it less well than David Cheshire, who is the director of that. What it means is that the students are, they can go into gaming, they can go into film, they can go into a number of industries related to film and gaming, anything having fundamentally to do with media. Mm-hmm. And so, and increasingly that is a almost like a gig economy as well. And so they're having to create their own businesses, and they're doing them quite successfully. I think Kay Beck, who ran the film operation for Georgia State and has for the last 15 years, they've created about 10 companies in Atlanta. We have a lot of folks who are into music, rap, et cetera, and a lot of those individuals began their career at Georgia State. So they're building companies now as we speak, and we're trying to sort of give them a rubric so that they can do it better, do it faster, and if, or if you will, fail fast.
Right. Now, you mentioned that the other universities are kind of exploring this entrepreneurship.
Oh, yes.
Right. How are you all playing together?
Ah, okay. Well, quite well, actually. Yeah, we compete a little bit on, you know, in certain dimensions. But truthfully, we have TYEU, which is a Thai, a variant of TIE. So Paul Lopez from TYEU has been organizing bi-monthly telephone conference calls all the, across the state. We just took the initiative to create the first Southeast Academic Conference for all entrepreneurial faculty. So not just Georgia, but Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, et cetera. And we'll be running that in town next month. So, you know, it's a share. I mean, we all have best practices. We all have slightly different issues that we want to come, and we want to see how we can do what we're doing better.
Now, is your university kind of creating a niche for yourself in this ecosystem?
Yeah. Okay. The niche is sort of in two parts. One, the building block approach. Okay. Most of the schools still, to the extent that they run these courses, tend to be focused in a particular discipline or domain. And so we intentionally built this out so that any student at Georgia State University can take any of our courses at the undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. And so we're hoping through this construction called a Bachelor of Interdisciplinary Studies that we can get 10 or 15 different units at the university having, in effect, entrepreneurship plus a domain specialization like creative media. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping for the same at the master's level.
So I'm thinking back to, you know, when I was 19 or 20 years old, that's some 5 or 6 failed businesses ago. And I'm envisioning having the opportunity to be exposed to this material, learn these skills, and practice in a safe environment. What a tremendous advantage that would have been, and it would probably would have saved me a heck of a lot of money.
We'll use that snippet on our website and Twitter feed.
Well, please keep up the good work. Let us know what we and our community can do here at the Business Radio X Network to support what you guys are doing. This is very encouraging. I am so delighted that you're doing it, and it's been a great pleasure having you in the studio this morning, man.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be interviewed by you, gentlemen.
So, where can our listeners go to learn more, have a conversation with you or someone on your faculty or talk to someone and learn more about this?
Sure. Well, the website is eni.gsu.edu. So that's a starting point. And there's contact forms, et cetera, et cetera. If somebody feels the urge to contact me, my email is rwelke@eni.gsu.edu.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Richard Welke. Hey, listen, can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Absolutely.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, you ready for the headliner, Lee? He's been very patient over there. He's been taking copious notes. So I think Dr. Welke here said something that had an impact on him. We have with us a CTO with Park Mobile. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Andrew Hamilton. Hey, man, how are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. So I did learn a few things this morning. First of all, about half an hour ago, I found out that Richard was actually my predecessor from a few years ago. So that's very interesting. So I'm sure he can actually tell me a lot more about the company's history than I can at this point. But there was a few things that Richard said that I thought was extremely interesting. I started programming when I was 14 years old in a Commodore 64. And I used to sell games to magazines. I'm not sure if a lot of listeners know this, but magazines used to actually publish code in them. And I wrote the code for some of those magazines back in the day. So that kind of got me started. So that's very interesting about you don't necessarily learn entrepreneurship, but it's built in. And that's continued throughout my career as well. So I thought it was extremely interesting.
So how did you go from kind of doing your own thing to now you're working for Park Mobile, which is a fairly large, successful entity?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually went to technical college. So my background was in computer science. I took computer science all the way up through graduation, and then I joined IBM. I was with IBM for about 10 years. IBM is a great trainer. They train you not only to concentrate on computer programming, but advance you in other ways as well. Project management, business orientation, ability to fail and learn from that failure if you have to. It's not what you necessarily want to do, but everybody learns from failure in some way or another. Richard was talking about that earlier. Another thing is as well is the we talked about embracing change. That's one of the biggest things I learned is that you've always got to have a second path to go down. So as you learn something and you think you're heading the right path to implement a program or a business, it may all not always go that way, and have a backup. Be ready for change, embrace change.
Now, but what was it like just from your, you were doing your own thing, and you were making your own rules, and you were, you know, your way was the right way, whether it was or not, right?
It was, but I tell you, as a 21-year-old, I think you need some rules for a little while. So I left college and moved to the States when I was just over 20 years old. So I think I actually enjoyed having somebody tell
some
me
structure.
What to do for a while, get some structure around it, absolutely. And that structure set the pace for later on. When I was 28, I joined WebMD here in Atlanta with Jeff Arnold, who's a great entrepreneur as well. He taught me a lot. There's only 30 people in the company when I started there at WebMD. And that
what
was really
that
my,
like from a culture
training.
Shock from IBM to WebMD? Or was it similar?
Well, one thing about IBM, even though it's a massive company with hundreds of thousands of employees, the projects I were on were two-year projects. Each one of those two-year projects were actually almost driven as if they were startups. Mm-hmm. So they started off with 10,
that?
15 people, and then there you go. Yep, absolutely. And then they grew into 50 to 100 people in the project towards the end of the project. So I was doing two-year stints on different projects, state projects.
So just when it got large, you bailed and then you jumped
basically.
Into another small one. So WebMD was just another two-year project in your head.
A two-year project went 3 years. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Here's another one who can't hold a job. But no, what this is telling me in no uncertain terms is this idea of intrapreneurship. This is not just some clever marketing phrase. I mean, this is how organizations, successful organizations, are getting the job done. So when you're looking for, when you're recruiting, developing people, are you looking for those qualities of resilience and that entrepreneurial mindset?
So one thing that I've been talking to my team at Park Mobile about recently is you don't always want to hire the best C# programmer or the best C++ programmer. A lot of the times, you want very, very good ones, but you want people that are going to work as a team and be part of that team. So one of my biggest things that I bring to the table is making sure we find the right people to actually work together. There's room for one or two people that can sit in the corner and just be individual contributors. But if you really want to make a difference and you want to produce applications that work well across all entities, you really need that team to be able to do that. And keep the team together as well is another big learning for me.
Right. So you don't want necessarily that kind of genius level, insane person that's got the super hard vision, but he can't get along with anybody else, right? That's kind of defeats the purpose, right?
There's room for one or two of those, but you need
right,
team players.
You can't have a room full of that.
That's correct.
That's going to make it tricky. Yeah.
That being said, you want great talent,
right?
But that talent that you bring in, you want that talent
along.
To work together. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
For Lee's benefit, because he probably doesn't know it like you and I do, what day-to-day, what does a chief technology officer do? What are you responsible for?
Lots of meetings. So I'm half joking on that. One of the things is actually reduce the number of meetings in the company as well. But basically my day is looking at the future and strategy of where we're going. The strategy today is not a 3 to 5 year roadmap anymore. It's just not. I mean, it's really a 3 month to 9 month to 12 month roadmap.
Wow.
Is strategy nowadays. Getting the right mix of tactical, making sure that things do not break. So you're also looking at the daily things that are going on, the weekly, maybe 3 weeks out. That's all the tactical things that you have to get done. Making sure that the systems are resilient, make sure they perform every day, make sure you're working with your clients. Sales, basically we do a lot of sales work as well, whether we like to call it that or not. A lot of people call it pre-sales or technical pre-sales, but you're going into the field with the people that are selling to give a technical representation of what we do. So it's not purely just, hey, look, this is flashy. This is where we're going in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. So you give that roadmap as well.
Well, let's before we get too far into that side of it, let's talk about Park Mobile in general. Like, what are you guys doing for folks? I know Park Mobile, I use it all the time. So why don't you share a little bit about what it is and how it works and why technology is so important, because it's kind of, that's what it is. It's technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So Park Mobile, you can also visit parkmobile.com. But basically, it's a software application that allows you to pay for parking in a number of locations around the US and actually around the world as well. There's affiliates in other countries too. In the US, I'll just use here in Atlanta, Ponce City Market, which, funnily enough, my old office used to be located there, so I used it all the time as well. You can actually download the application instead of going up to a meter. And you'll see this at Pond City Market. You'll see people 20 deep at the meters for some reason. They don't know that they can use the mobile application from Park Mobile to pay for their parking. But simply register your card, credit card, register your car, which is the license number, and put the zone number in, and you can pay for the parking. You can also extend the parking too. So if you're sitting down at a business meeting or at dinner, at lunch, and you go over your 1 hour that you paid for, you can actually go in and extend that by 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. So you're
you don't even have to remember, because Park Mobile is going to remind you.
It's absolutely right.
Wow,
it has a timer,
that
it reminds
is
you.
Cool.
So, you know, it's a really cool application. One of the other things, though, is people don't really pay attention that in Atlanta, you can also pay at Park Atlanta, too. So all the meters on the streets, all around GSU and all around you know, Georgia Tech and where our office is at Spring Street, you can actually use the Park Mobile mobile application to pay for parking at those locations too. In fact, Pond City Market has started to get some awareness around that. One of the biggest challenges that we have is engagement and awareness. But it's really improving a lot over the last few
months.
All right,
so you have your sales and marketing team. They go out and they're calling on whoever makes those decisions at a Pond City Market. And then they get some questions and pretty soon they say, I don't know, but I got a couple of smart folks back at the shop. Let's get back together, and that's where some of your team sits down.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm sure you've all seen this in business, right? There's some promises made out there that you've got to fulfill, and that's fine. You asked about job responsibilities. Part of my job responsibility is fulfilling those promises that sales and other people make, and it's great. It's part of the challenge.
Well, it's also an opportunity for innovation. Just defending us sales guys here for a moment, because I have been known to come back to the shop and say, "I sold it, so you need to make it." And they go, "Well, you know, you let me make it, then you go sell it." But that is a path for innovation. I mean, they could come back and say, you know, the client really expressed an interest in this and this. Do you think we could do that? That happens, right?
Absolutely. So for the good or the bad, the sales team plus the municipalities and the clients that we have do come back with some great suggestions. We also get some of the suggestions internally too. We recently opened up an email address where you can email us and give us suggestions on how to improve parking from our internal employees as well.
So now, is your business primarily like the Pond City Markets of the world, or are they I'm pretty sure Chattanooga, the city of Chattanooga, uses you. So
that's correct. So it's mostly municipalities is the biggest. They have the most spaces. But the kind of the niche markets like Pond City Markets, there's other ones around the place. It's also the reservation side, which would be airport parking, event parking, and, those make up a big piece of it as well. But yes, it's a combination of niche players like Pond City Market, the municipalities, airports, and event parking. That's really the collection of parking spaces that we handle.
And then when you're working with these, like the needs of Pond City Market obviously are different than the needs of a city.
That's
right?
Correct.
I mean, a parking spot, it's a parking spot, but they're a business and, the other people are just, they're spots on the street. I guess they're trying to monetize in the most efficient manner.
That's correct. So there's a lot of cost for municipalities to maintain parking meters, to maintain the parking kiosks that they have as well. And that cost goes away if you can turn up 100% into mobile parking. Mm-hmm. Instead of having to have the kiosks and the meters, you can replace all that with a handheld application that's already on your phone. That's fantastic. You're correct about the niche players like Pond City Market. The difference there is validations, the ability to validate those parking events as well.
So like the Pond City Market, the customer might want to be validated their thing so they don't have to pay. So you have to be able to handle that kind of a transaction.
Yes.
The person on the street, there's no validation to park near Grady. Right.
Yeah, that actually is interesting because you see the crossover now, right? So at Pond City Market, is a retail and restaurant space. So people do expect to get validated and to have free parking. If they shop and spend a couple hundred dollars at a restaurant.
Yeah. So why am I going to get hit for another $6,
Yeah, you mentioned, Lee, that you don't expect it necessarily when you're parking at Park Atlanta on the street. But there's no reason why you couldn't cross over now and have validations outside a coffee shop for somebody that did park in the street. So there's definitely a crossover there. Majority of the features that we develop are reusable across any of those. In fact, it's the same application. So those features are available across any of those.
So I don't know that if this is a good idea. And in fact, it may very well not be, but I suspect the technology could be made to also help the enforcement side.
We do.
Oh,
yes.
You do. Then it was a great idea. It's, you know, 10 years too late maybe, but
yes.
So you can help the enforcement side.
Absolutely.
You can streamline that. You can let the person know, hey, 23B's, you know, out or getting ready to be out of time.
Yeah. And that's certainly one of the features that we're expanding upon. So today we do it by plate license number. So license plate number. And that is broadcast out to the enforcement agencies so they know if somebody has paid or hasn't paid. And the extension of that is exactly what you're saying, which is geocoding each spot. So you know exactly who's left a spot or who's still in the spot as well. So, you know, there is more to it. The street parking is actually easier in that respect because those are numbered spots and you're paying for a numbered zone spot versus the Ponce City Market, which is general availability. So it's a lot easier to track that on the street.
Now, as part of the monetization is when you have the app and you know I'm at the mall or you know where I'm at, that you can then filter an ad to me about a certain thing. Like, hey, go to this coffee shop and you get, they'll validate your parking. You won't even have to pay. Like, are you doing something like that?
So that'd be a good crossover. Right now, we do not do that. We try and keep it as succinct as possible. So really, it's just registration and payment. And that's pretty much it. But there's lots of ways that you could see that could expand in the future, which is advertising a local business. At Park Mobile, we always want to make sure it's an enhancement to the customer experience. So we don't just want to put advertisements out there that are not relevant or not targeted. But if it was very relevant, literally you're parking and you know there's a great location that may be something you would be interested in, then that is a good opportunity to give discounts or to show somebody a location. But it has to enhance that customer experience. When you look at the network model for Park Mobile, it's not just about one location. You mentioned Chattanooga, but it's Charlotte. It's all these locations where people have used the app in the past, and we want to encourage them to be able to use that app anywhere within the United States. So that's really the network benefit. We want to keep that customer engaged, keep them happy, and really make them feel part of the network.
Now, as a challenge for the CTO, I would imagine when you read this morning about Delta, that's probably the things that scare you half to death, right? Like this morning, Delta had major outages all over the world because the more technology that's in use, the more everybody's leaning on it, everybody's relying on it, and then a failure at any level, it just creates chaos across the whole system.
It does. And not saying that you'd ever want this to happen, but if there was an error within our system or enforcement system, for instance, you may see erroneous tickets. I would never want that to happen. So one of my challenges is going to make sure that these systems are reliable, they're up and running all the time, no interruptions, and everything's flowing through. But absolutely. I'm actually on a flight to Houston this afternoon, maybe.
Maybe, right.
So I'll probably find out right after this show if that's still on or not. But,
So do you guys, and ladies, CTOs, execs in this space, do you guys get together periodically and hang out and share ideas and best practices? Is there like an association or a club or Margarita Mondays or something that you guys?
I wish it was as good as Margarita Mondays. So I'm actually on the board of directors for Technology Association of Georgia.
Yeah.
It's massive over here. You've interviewed people from there, Tino probably, and a few others.
Yeah.
So that is our
that's your club.
Our club, basically. Yeah. And it's social. I mean, there's some social aspects to it. But I also run the CIO roundtable as well. Mm-hmm. We have meetings probably once a quarter, and it's a panel usually. So we have 14 or so CIOs, CTOs. Speaking at the panel, and we have a number of guest audience members as well. So yes, it's a club. I wish it was a little bit more social sometimes, but that's okay. We'll take
it. I would think that would be very important to hang out with people who have, you know, similar challenges, but enough differences in their world to offer some real valuable perspective. I think I would be very thirsty for that if I were to ever get a real job in one like yours. I think I'll be thirsty for that interaction.
Absolutely, we do. We bring up a couple of subjects in the panels and we talk through those subjects. Retention's a big thing here in Georgia, retaining the best employees. It's a very, very competitive market out there, so that's something that we talk about. We talk about how to retain employees. You'll keep people happy, keep them interested in what they're doing, training. We also talk about technologies. There's a good mix actually here in Atlanta of what you consider more of a traditional IT director CIO role, which is hardware, software, infrastructure, keeping systems running versus emerging now into more of the, I know the terminology has changed over time, but the CTO role generally is more in the engineering software, making sure that things, processes flow and things work the way they should. But there's a good crossover here in Atlanta of people that are more in the manufacturing infrastructure side, hosting side versus the software development side. So there's a good mix.
Now, are you finding Atlanta is a good place for talent in terms of they're kind of locally grown, or do you have to bring them in from outside?
So this is something where Richard could probably jump in here a little bit too. So, you know, we went to Georgia Tech several times in other companies I've worked for. And when we interviewed the Georgia Tech students in the class, we went to class basically. 60% of them were not staying in Georgia. And that's a big problem for us. So part of that's they came from other states to come and study here. And also that we have to, as a community, encourage people that Georgia is a fantastic hub for technology. And it is. We find great people here. But you know, encouraging young people, graduates from GSU and Georgia Tech to stay here in Georgia, I think that's something that as a community we need to work on.
What do you think, Richard?
Oh, I think you should work on it, definitely.
Do you see the same thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, back when I held Alex's role or Andrew's role, we ended up actually having to go into community colleges. And there's a lot of, there's different levels of skills that are needed, you know, so keeping a database going and occasionally running, you know, cleaning it up, okay, is a sort of different skill level than the sales guy come in and says, geez, we need to make the following modification to the metering scheme so that they can only be there for 2 hours at 3 o'clock, but at 5 o'clock, they can stay overnight, et cetera, et cetera. And so that requires a lot of code depth and understanding and somebody that, you know, really can do it clean and well and quickly. Mm-hmm. So you need a whole range of individuals. I think you find the Georgia Tech students in particular, because it's a top-rated computer science department in the U.S., okay, are going to be heavily recruited by Silicon Valley. And they believe, right or wrong, okay, that there are more like them that they can learn from. And they're all interested in not just the trade and skills that they picked up in the university. What they're interested in is working with other people who are operating at an even higher level,
right,
so that they can get to that level as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We get a large number of senior developers here in Atlanta, people that want to set down their roots.
So after they've, you know, battled and then done that, they're like, hey, well, I need a lower cost of living. I need a better quality of life and less kind of chaotic lifestyle.
That's correct.
Frenetic.
I was saying that, though. I mean, go back to Ponce City Market. I mean, that's really encouraging a lot of people to stay here in the city, you know, not leave and, you know, get jobs locally, too. So that's helping a lot as well.
And also we have the fintech whole area, right, springing up in Midtown, which I believe is why Park Mobile in part moved down there, is because really, in a sense, they are a fintech company.
Yep, absolutely. NCR is moving back in town. There's a number of large corporations moving back into town to form that fintech community. But absolutely agree with you on that. Yep.
So now for Park Mobile, what's next for you guys?
I mean, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, there's the core technology side, which is very interesting. Ability to take pictures of your license plate numbers, credit cards, and zone numbers, make things a lot more streamlined, you know, excellent in that way. But also just extending out. I mean, one of the things that we looked at in the last few weeks is working with a large corporation in Seattle to put our application in Dash. So instead of going to the mobile application in hand, you'll actually be able to pay for parking, find parking, and, you know, basically possibly other services too, but directly in your in-dash module. So your GPS system, basically.
So it'll tell me there's an empty spot around the corner?
That's correct. We're actually prototyping right now with a large corporation out of Germany. So I won't go into too much detail, but that is in progress. So I'm very excited about it.
So now the device that's in front of the spot can tell it's empty or not?
So
right now it can't, right? Or can it?
For some of the garages, we can. We can tell spots are available. On-street parking is a little bit more difficult. So one thing that's a good segue there, one of the things that we are working on is a availability propensity, just to predict whether or not a space should be available based on parking behavior that we've gathered in the past. Mm-hmm. So using prior behavior, historical behavior, to determine the likelihood a space has been available in a given block zone or a given street, et cetera. So that is in progress.
So then your app can guide me to a potentially empty spot.
That's correct. And that's using previous historical parking data.
Wow. Sign me up for that.
And yep. In some cities, what are called wired cities now, they're actually embedding sensors in the road so that they know whether a spot is available or not available.
Yeah, smart cities is actually a huge topic over the last few months, if not last 6 months to a year. But defining what a smart city is, and Richard brought one of those up, which is knowing exactly whether or not spaces are available, but also Wi-Fi throughout the city, additional payment devices. There's kiosks in a lot of city corners now that have Wi-Fi built in. So it's really, what is a smart city and how can we be part of that? And that's very exciting.
So now what do you need more of?
We need a lot of developers. We need to bring a lot of that in-house. The history part more, you mentioned some of the challenges that I have as a CTO.
Right.
So one of the challenges is you end up, whether it's good or bad, have other people's decisions. So you're living with some of that, and you need to make your own decisions and clean it up if you can. We do a lot of outsourcing. Some of it's great. Some of it I want to revisit and bring some of that in-house. I do believe that we have a great pool here of engineers in Georgia, and I'd like to utilize that. So we are recruiting. We're looking for web developers, web designers, .NET developers, across the board, basically.
And then from a business standpoint, you need more municipalities? That's what the
That's
priority
correct.
Is?
Yep. To extend the network, we're reaching out constantly to municipalities. We're also starting relationships with third party. One of the things I noticed coming into this business is your partners are actually your competitors as well. So there's a lot of parking companies, whether it's LAS or linear parking systems. There's a lot of companies out there that don't do what we do. So even though they may be considered competitors, we actually help them because we have the mobile payment device. So yes is the answer. We need more spots, more municipalities, and we're constantly going out after them.
Now, so as smart cities, the more smart cities there are, the better it'll be for you, right? Because you play very nicely with them.
That's correct. And it's very green as well. I mean, you're not printing things off. You're not having cars go around picking up coins from parking meters. So, using the phone is the easiest, most economic and eco-friendly way of parking. You just don't have all these receipts flying around to put on windscreens. You don't have, as I said, transportation going around picking up coins and everything else that they have to do. So, yes, it's definitely part of a smart city.
All right. Well, if somebody wanted to learn more to get the app, I'm sure it's available anywhere apps are, but why don't you share a little bit about where to get the app?
Yeah, absolutely. For information on it, parkmobile.com is the best place to go to get information. But also, if you go to the Apple Store or the Google Play Store, you will see us. We're actually top rated. So you'll find us very easily just by searching for Park or Park Mobile.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Wilkie.
And thank you, Lee.
And this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.